welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. The topic today is, can China really become self-sufficient in semiconductors? With me is my podcast partner, Mike Gianfagna.
Good morning, Dan.
And our guest is semiconductor industry expert, Robert Mayer.
Hey, good morning, Dan.
Between Mike, Robert, and I, we have close to 100 years of semiconductor experience, so this should be an interesting discussion. First, the question at hand, simple yes or no, guys. Can China really become self-sufficient in semiconductors? Mike?
My answer is no.
How about you, Robert?
My answer is a qualified yes, depending upon how much time we're talking about.
Okay. Well, first, let's dig into it. Let's talk about the logic side with SMIC. SMIC was founded in 2000 and is the largest foundry in China today. I started working with SMIC in the early days on foundation IP, and let me tell you, it was an exciting time. You know, I had very high hopes that SMIC, which is backed by the Chinese government, would help change the foundry landscape and bring more competition to the Taiwanese foundries, which are TSMC and UMC. SMIC really was following in the footsteps of UMC and Chartered Semiconductor by providing TSMC compatible processes, which started at 0.35 micron down to 28 nanometer. You know, unfortunately, SMIC was a little too compatible and was sued by TSMC for misappropriation of intellectual property. I believe that was in 2006. That ended up costing SMIC $200 million and, you know, 10% of their company. The next big disruption for SMIC was FinFETs, where TSMC compatibility train came to a screeching halt. And that was not just for SMIC, that was everybody, you know, UMC and Global Foundries and such. But you know what was happening is everybody, Qualcomm, Broadcoms, they were doing their initial design at TSMC. You know, TSMC was doing all the heavy lifting. And then once it, you know, made it into production, they would just send the GDS2 over to the other foundries and they could do second, you know, third and even fourth sourcing, which, you know, took the wind out of TSMC's sales, right? Because that's where the bulk of the manufacturing was. That's where all the profits were. So, you know, when they hit FinFETs, the whole foundry landscape changed again, right? Because the only people that successfully lost FinFETs are Intel and TSMC and Samsung. But, you know, back to the China market, back then it was, you had to use SMIC, you know, dictated by the Chinese government, unless it was, you know, humanly impossible to use SMIC. So they really had a built-in market. And if you look at the growth of semiconductor electronics, semiconductor-based electronics in China, that was the big growth market that everybody was pursuing. So SMIC really was a potentially disruptive influence in the semiconductor ecosystem.
Yes, I too have a fairly lengthy background with SMIC. I had worked on the initial public offering of SMIC over 20 years ago on Wall Street, and had made numerous visits to SMIC prior to it being a public company when it was just being formed by Richard Chang, and had the privilege of wandering around the fab back in the early days. And I think in the early days of SMIC, there was quite an ambitious agenda to be a major player on the semiconductor landscape. And obviously, as pointed out by Dan, they ran into a little bit of IP trouble. But it was still revolutionary in its time, in that bringing that much technology into China was unique. Most of the technology at the time, again, was from the U.S. And their whole model was quite different, and their management team was different. Richard Chang was certainly a different operator than the rest in the industry. And even the people operating the fabs were quite different. A lot of young women from the hinterlands of China who lived literally across the street in dormitories, who were running the fab. It was quite different from what was seen at Intel or in the U.S. And I think there were the early aspirations sort of fell away as it became apparent that things were much more difficult. Now, as the Chinese government has certainly gotten interested in being more self-sufficient in semis, I think the last numbers were they consume more than 60% of the world's production of semis, but make maybe a little bit more than 15%, that they've sort of redoubled their efforts. And I think SMIC has become the clear sort of poster child for that. So I think the focus has been reignited at SMIC, but the difficulties still remain.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that SMIC came out with FinFETs, 14 nanometer, you know, a couple years ago, and still it hasn't caught on. They're, you know, it's a huge challenge for them. And even UMC did the same thing. They have 14 nanometer, but it really didn't yield well, and it was very hard to design to. You know, they brought in double patterning, and you know, that has all sorts of difficulties. But even today, 14 nanometer is still a very small percentage of SMIC's revenues. I think it's 1% or maybe 2%. So, you know, China's kind of stuck in the older generations, which SMIC is actually doing quite well. You know, they have a bunch of fabs, 300 millimeter and 200 millimeter. But, you know, going forward, how are they going to survive without FinFETs? You know, I think that's going to be a huge challenge. And now some of the equipment that's required for the even smaller FinFET geometries, you know, is not available to the Chinese market. But what about memories, Robert? I know you follow memories very well. I spent some time in China when the memory boom was just starting, and I toured some facilities. You know, how are they doing today on the memory side?
I think they're certainly doing better. The big question in memory was where were they going to get their process and design technology from? Obviously, in Jinhua's case, it was somewhat misappropriated from Micron with the help of UMC, perhaps. And as we all know, what happened to Jinhua because of that. I think that there is certainly enough access through legal means or less than legal means to obtain a lot of the process technology, but there's still a huge amount of know-how, huge amount of tribal knowledge. You need the, you know, not only the process recipe, you need access to the tools. If that is appropriately restricted, it's going to be very, very difficult. You know, as an example, with Yangtze Memory, who's, entering the NAND market, one of the keys to making multi-level NAND is etch tools that can do these very high aspect ratio etches. And they're really only available from Lam Research in the U.S. So if those tools were withheld, that would be rather difficult for them to be a significant player in NAND. And that's much the same as we see in SMIC with access to EUV tools, which they really, really need to get, you know, sort of to 14 nanometers and below 14 nanometers. If they don't have access to those tools, it's going to be difficult and realistically impossible to make further progress.
Yeah, and that brings us also to the ecosystem surrounding, you know, digital logic and memory design. You know, TSMC has done a very nice job creating a huge ecosystem of IP and EDA and services and equipment manufacturers, you know, that rally together and put in, you know, billions of dollars of R&D efforts for the greater good of, you know, the foundry business. And that's just going to be hard to do in China. You know, based on the relationship, you know, the uncertain relationship between the governments and such. So I think that's another challenge. And, you know, of course, the supply chain is also an issue. You know, Mike, do you have some comments on the supply chain?
It's interesting. If you look at any of the major forces in the market, nobody is self-sufficient. Everybody's relying on some other country for some other key technology. I mean, Robert sort of observed it there. I heard something recently from Handel Jones from International Business Strategies, who's actually been looking at the China market for a long time. He did a first book called China America, I believe, like a really long time ago, before it was fashionable to talk about China, literally. And he made the same observation. EUV is a huge issue. It's triggering, you know, below 5 nanometer fab. It's also critical for some advanced memory technologies. He also talks about EDA tools for semiconductors is another area. So there's some critical pieces that just are missing. And, you know, the point he made, and I tend to agree with him, is while China is accelerating in a number of areas, we'll probably touch on those, there's some critical pieces missing. They're a huge market. They need enablement. Other countries have the enabling technology, and there's an opportunity to float everybody's boat here with a little more collaborative attitude, which, as we know, hasn't been that situation hasn't been the best lately. So, you know, that's probably a good strategy for everybody here to get back to a more even keeled you know, international trade situation. But there's a lot of opportunities, but China doing it alone, that's a tall order for all those things. It really is.
I think people don't realize or recognize exactly how large the community or the infrastructure is needed to make semiconductor devices. You know, you're talking about now a fab that might cost $7 to $10 billion, have literally hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of equipment, you know, process technology that is minimally 500 steps. EUV technology has been under development for 30 years now, and billions upon billions of dollars have been spent. You know, even if China managed to get its hands on the copy of plans from ASML to build a tool and try to copy it, the lenses that are used in EUV tools are made by Zeiss in Germany, by former East Germans who've spent their 30 years of their lives hand polishing glass to atomic precision. And then it's cryogenically cooled, it weighs many tons. It's, you know, you just can't pick up the phone and order that stuff off the shelf. And that type of infrastructure and that type of community that supports the industry, whether it's in Japan or Korea or Taiwan or the US, simply can't be easily duplicated. So you're either part of the community or you're not.
All right, I think we've covered the challenges. Let's talk about some of the upside, some of the successes of the semiconductor and related industries in China. Robert?
Yeah, well, I would point out that China has done quite well in both the LED and solar industries, which are somewhat cousins to the semiconductor industry and have similar but much simpler technology there. You've seen what's happened. They've come in. Virtually every province in China has its own LED factory or its own solar factory, and they compete with each other to give incentives to manufacturers to come in and set up shop. The obvious difference is that, you know, you can set up an LED factory for maybe 50 million bucks with some relatively simplistic tools. And the key tool, which is an MOCVD reactor, used to be made by a German company and a US company, Vico, was copied by AMEC in China, and they came up with a viable copy. So China is currently technologically self-sufficient in LED manufacturing and doesn't need outside help. And it's similarly the case in the solar industry. The technology was simplistic enough such that internal tools could be developed within China, and the process was simple enough. There's really not a lot of design process for either LEDs or solar. I think the next closest technology is obviously the memory industry versus the logic industry, because everybody understands the design structure of DRAM or even multi-level NAND. But the limitation there is more on the manufacturing side. Can you get the equipment? Can you get EUV? Can you get the etch tools, et cetera? You perhaps don't need as sophisticated design tools as Dan was talking about earlier, but you can't even get the manufacturing tools that you need.
You know, there's a few areas that I think are literally shining stars for China. I mean, AI is one of them. There's been a lot of work in China on artificial intelligence. It's improving productivity across multiple industries, and I think they're doing a really good job there. I mean, if you look at the deployment of autonomous vehicles, China is ahead. I think I've heard several folks from large corporations in China, automotive players that are predicting, full autonomous vehicle deployment like significantly before anywhere else in the world. Now, that's a pretty good crapshoot when it is truly autonomous, the level five autonomy and all of that. But China definitely seems to be ahead there. And I think it's a combination of the AI prowess of the organizations there, as well as the government. I mean, the strong government support and government control helps here, helps to deploy things like that. So I think they're going to be very much ahead in those areas. 5G is another one where China's doing very well. I mean, the world's catching up, obviously, but they have been on the forefront of that. So there's a lot of shining stars there that indicate China's a fantastic market for proving out some of these new technologies, but there are missing pieces. It is a massive market. If I step back a little bit, there's an obvious opportunity for everyone here. With just a little more collaboration, everybody's going to make a lot more money. So, and that was a point that Handel was making in his presentation as well. I tend to agree with him. There's something to unlock a much bigger opportunity here for everybody, including China.
So Robert, one of the other things I want to touch on is some of the investment that China has made, where the money's gone. I mean, they've committed, over $200 billion for this effort of semiconductor independence. Where has all that money gone?
Well, I think the bigger question is, does that money even exist, or has it really truly been allocated? One of the issues I've had with China in dealing with China over the past 20 years is separating out reality from fantasy. A lot of people talk about having money or talk about having backers for new ventures, and I would say less than 50% of the companies I've dealt with in China are what they claim to be. I think of late, what we've seen is Tsinghua, which is an offshoot of the famous Beijing University, which was sort of the industry leader in semiconductor technology, and an offshoot of them of that organization had bought Mattson Technology, has been an investor, has really invested in the semiconductor industry, has defaulted on bonds, and looks to be, I believe they defaulted on 150 million or so, and are looking at potentially defaulting on $2 billion worth of bonds. It's interesting to note that the government has not stepped in here and rescued them, which is something I would have expected to happen, especially that the government claims to have this $100 billion, $200 billion checkbook to push the industry forward. But if no one, cashes the check, what does that really mean? Are some of these efforts going to, sort of fall to the wayside? Are people going to be willing to throw money at them to continue to do these things? They've used the public stock markets and debt markets as vehicles to get funding to do this, which is what anybody would do. But if the risk of not getting paid back is too high, those markets will be closed to them. And certainly, having the technology is half the equation, but having the money to do it is the other half of the equation. And if you can't do that, that's certainly going to hold up their implementation of their plans.
Yeah, I saw this investment on the fabless side. So last count, there was over 1,000 fabless companies in China that were developing, chips for different applications. AI is a big one, of course, and automotive. I mean, the number of automotive-based fabless companies in China was just, it was a huge bubble, and it still is. But, fabless companies don't take a lot of investment. But, if it was really deja vu of our fabless explosion in the 80s and 90s, when we first got the foundries and, all these fabless companies came out. So, 1,000 or so fabless companies in China, how many are actually going to succeed in the market? And, I did visit some fabless companies in China, and I was surprised to see, their presentations, and they really were focused on getting more government money or more, outside money versus focused on, penetrating specific markets, working with the top customers, because they really don't have access to the US customers. So it's just really focused on China. But I think it's going to be a much higher rate of not successful companies. You know, in the U.S., you could say, you know, 1 out of 10, you know, 1 out of 20, maybe, you know, maybe more. But in China, I think that's the amount of failed companies is going to be much higher for the fabless business. But, you know, one of the things they struggle with is tools. You know, we talked about EDA. It is even harder now to get EDA tools. And China is putting a lot of money into EDA companies through acquisitions and such. There are a couple of very large China EDA companies evolving. But still, you know, all the money that's been invested, I really don't think there's been a very high return on investment, at least from the United States standards.
I would certainly agree with that. If it were being done for profitability, they haven't accomplished that goal. But, you know, if you look at the progress of the semiconductor industry, let's suggest that the semiconductor industry started in the U.S., Japan entered the industry, then we've seen Korea and Taiwan enter the industry. And, you know, profitability was perhaps not number one on everyone's mind. It was really gaining market share in the beginning and gaining know-how and technology. You know, when you look at the LED and solar markets, there's certainly not a lot of profitability there. If anything, they're losing money in a lot of those markets, but they have wiped out all the other players and come to dominate the market. I think that's one of the fears that the semiconductor industry has, that China is not profit motivated, it's just market share and independence motivated, and, you know, could destroy the memory market by just, you know, dumping product on it to take share. And that's not too far away from Samsung. Samsung became very dominant by certainly being ahead in technology, but that enabled them to be the price leader and crush the competition on pricing and memory, which is obviously a commodity-like market. So I think that will be an issue. Can they get to a point where product, particularly in memory, can be sold at a competitive price or at a price that takes substantial share in the market?
All right. So what's next for China? You know, what do they have to do to be successful here, Robert?
Well, I think we'll see. A lot of this has to do with the new Biden administration coming in. I think Biden is somewhat boxed in that Trump left him in a bit of a box as he exits here. I don't think Biden wants to be seen as being weak on China, so I don't think we're turning around any of these trade issues. I think over time we'll probably get to back to a more normalized relationship. I don't know that the sanctions are going to be lifted anytime quickly. Key sanction, you know, such as ASML not being able to ship EUV tools, is one that remains to be seen what happens there. And the recently enacted sort of blacklisting of SMIC, following on blacklisting Huawei and a number of other companies, if that gets reversed or if that stays there. I don't anticipate that changing anytime over the next 6 months to a year, perhaps a little further in the new administration. We might see some easing of that depending upon whether China takes a more cooperative stance or whatever. I don't think they're going to work their way out on their own. They really need to get cooperation from the U.S. and the international community to make more forward progress in semiconductor technology.
I agree with you on that, Robert. I think that, you know, getting back to this Handel Jones presentation, a comment he made is, you know, they are behind in some key technology areas that we've observed, but his point is in 5 to 10 years, that can be different and they can close the gap. So I think that's the time frame we're talking about here. So what happens over the next 5 to 10 years is anybody's guess, but my sense is that there will be more normalized relationships. Things will get back to a more international market. So maybe China doesn't have to reinvent everything within their borders. And if that evolution happens, I think their market grows. And I think the opportunity for the rest of the world to participate in what's arguably a huge market, that grows too. So I kind of, maybe I'm too much of an optimist. I've been accused of that plenty of times, but I think that there is an opportunity here for, you know, the entire water level to go up for everyone with just a little bit of normalized relationship. And you're right, it's not going to happen in the next 6 months to a year, but over 5 to 10 years, taking the long game, it could be a very different world in a positive way. We'll see.
Just to add on to that, I think you know, in some ways, it's an issue, I wouldn't say of greed, but of just wanting to continue to do business. You look at the, I don't know, 40, 50 billion in semiconductor equipment, and the number one customer for all semiconductor equipment companies is China, and the fastest growing customer of all semiconductor equipment companies is China. So, you know, Applied Materials, KLA, ASML, Lam Research, et cetera, et cetera. Even our foreign competitors, Hitachi, Tokyo Electron, and the rest, really want to do business with China because there's, you know, billions and billions of dollars worth of sales riding on it. So no one wants to see that the trade barriers remain up, but it hurts both sides. You know, so I think eventually there will be some relaxation of that. How much there is and how quickly that happens, that remains to be seen.
So, Bob, where does this leave Taiwan? You know, TSMC is the center of the fabless semiconductor universe, and China is, you know, has made claims of ownership of Taiwan, you know, similar to what they've done in Hong Kong. You know, they say Taiwan has a silicon shield, right? Because the China takes over Taiwan, you know, that's going to affect the entire world, and the entire world would then act against it. But, you know, what do you think is going to happen in Taiwan? Because if China is pushed to their back against the wall and is not allowed access to semiconductor technology, you know, what other choice do they have?
Well, I've been writing on that very topic for literally 20 years now, and more so over the last 5 years. 20 years ago, I wrote an article or a research note when China was flying missiles over Taiwan, and Taiwan was the one and only place where PC motherboards were made. I suggested that there was a risk to the entire PC industry. And now, if anything, the risk has gotten worse, because really Apple is even more dependent now that they've moved completely away from Intel for their laptops and all that. And the U.S., if Intel outsources more to Taiwan, is more dependent. I think it's a huge prize, and it's very hard for China to ignore it. It's, you know, an hour boat ride away. I think it's not a matter of if China will reunite or forcibly reunite Taiwan. I think it's just a matter of when. Will that happen in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? I think it's essentially inevitable. China will grow in strength. China will want to do that. I think it's managing that effort. I think certainly having the leverage of TSMC helps Taiwan, but I don't think that silicon shield will last forever. I also think it's in the U.S.'s best interest to, you know, bring as much technology back to the U.S., not just, you know, a token fab from TSMC in Arizona, but a real effort to be self-sufficient aside from Taiwan. So I understand the silicon shield thing, but that's certainly not going to last forever. And depending upon how aggressive China gets, and if this tension with the U.S. lasts even longer, it gives them, you know, a perfect excuse to go do something, you know, perhaps a bear hug strategy with Taiwan, or blockade Taiwan, or who knows what. It could be, you know, quite disastrous for not only the U.S. economy, but for the global economy as well.
Yeah, I think it's of the world's best interest to keep Taiwan independent, but you're right. That's going to be a long, long, hard battle for China and Taiwan and the U.S. and everybody else. Okay, we're going to have to stop here to stay under the 30-minute limit, but great content. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Robert. We're definitely going to have you back. We have so much more to talk about, but that's it for today. That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.